taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
We had a fun. Greetings. This is podcast number 12 of Blast the Right. I'm Jack Clark from therationalradical.com. www.therationalradical.com. That opening music was called Taking My Country Back. Today we have three segments. The first segment is called 15 Terrible Things That Liberals Have Done. The next segment will consist of a couple of audio clips. There's a lying Bill O'Reilly clip. Then there's a cowardly draft-dodging O'Reilly clip. And then there's a Bush-bashing Fox News clip. Fox News bashing Bush? Yes, you'll have to listen and see what I mean. The final segment is called Dangerous Right-Wing Myths About the U.S. Role in the World. Let's get right to the first segment. It's called 15 Terrible Things Liberals Have Done. This is one of these pieces that's been floating around the internet and that gets sent from person to person. I received it and thought it was just great, and I've modified it for the podcast. What are the 15 terrible things liberals have done? We'll check them out by following an average Joe through his day. 1. Joe gets up at 6 a.m. and fills his coffee pot with water to prepare his morning coffee. The water is clean and good because some tree-hugging liberal fought for minimum water quality standards. 2. With his first swallow of water, he takes his daily medication. His medications are safe to take because some stupid liberal commie fought to set up the Food and Drug Administration to ensure the safety of these drugs and that they work as advertised. 3. All but $10 of his medications are paid for by his employer's medical plan because some liberal union workers fought their employers for paid medical insurance. Now Joe gets it too. 4. Joe prepares his morning breakfast, bacon and eggs. Joe's bacon is safe to eat because some girly man liberal fought for laws to regulate the meatpacking industry. 5. In the morning shower, Joe reaches for a shampoo. His bottle is properly labeled with each ingredient because some crybaby liberal fought for his right to know what he was putting on his body and how much of each ingredient it contained. 6. Joe dresses, walks outside, and takes a deep breath. The air he breathes is clean because some environmentalist wacko liberal fought for the laws to stop industries from polluting our air. 7. Joe walks on the government-provided sidewalk to the subway station for his government-subsidized ride to work. It saves him considerable money in parking and transportation fees because some fancy-pants liberal fought for affordable public transportation. 8. Joe begins his workday. He has a good job with excellent pay, medical benefits, retirement, paid holidays, and vacation, because some lazy union members fought and died for these working standards. 9. If Joe is hurt on the job or becomes unemployed, he'll get workman's compensation or unemployment insurance checks because some stupid liberal didn't think he should lose his home because of his temporary misfortune. 10. It's noontime and Joe needs to make a bank deposit so he can pay some bills. Joe's deposit is federally insured by the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation because some godless liberal wanted to protect Joe's money from unscrupulous bankers who ruined the banking system before the Great Depression. 11. Joe also has to pay his Fannie Mae underwritten mortgage and below market federal student loan because some elitist liberal decided that Joe and the society would be better off if his housing was more affordable and if he were educated and earned more money over his lifetime. Joe also attended a state-funded university. 12. Joe's home from work. He plans to visit his father this evening at his farm home in the country. He's going to drive out there in his car. His car is among the safest in the world because some America-hating liberal fought for car safety standards to go along with the taxpayer-funded roads. 13. Joe arrives at his boyhood home. His was the third generation to live in the house financed by the Farmers Home Administration because bankers didn't want to make rural loans. 14. The house didn't have electricity until some big government liberal stuck his nose where it didn't belong and demanded rural electrification. And 15. Joe is happy to see his father, who is now retired. His father lives on Social Security and a union pension because some wine-drinking, cheese-eating liberal made sure he could take care of himself so Joe wouldn't have to. So, is Joe a liberal? Let's see what happens next. Joe gets back in his car for the ride home and turns on a radio show. The host keeps saying that liberals are bad and conservatives are good. He doesn't mention that the beloved Republicans have fought against every protection and benefit Joe enjoys throughout his day. Joe agrees with the radio host. We don't need these big government liberals ruining our lives. I'm a self-made man who believes everyone should take care of themselves just like I have. That's the end of my version of the piece circulating on the internet. Now some additional comments. We see that, no, Joe's not a liberal. He's a typical brain-dead right-winger who consistently supports those whose policies are designed to impoverish him. That radio host that Joe listens to and adores could very well be Rush Limbaugh. Listen to what Rush, in a rare honest moment, says he has in store for Joe.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well. Many of the 15 terrible things you heard that liberals did were started under Roosevelt. Those that weren't are the offspring of Roosevelt's New Deal. Right-wingers want to destroy the New Deal. Joe doesn't realize that when right-wingers destroy the New Deal, right-wingers will destroy Joe's life as well. As I was going through this list of 15 terrible things that liberals do, you may have thought of other examples of how Joe, or even your own friendly local right-winger, may have benefited from the evil government that they so want to destroy. Why not ask your friendly local right-winger a question about whichever one of these or other government programs you know that they benefit from? I'll bet liberal government programs all of a sudden don't seem so terrible to your friendly local right-winger when he or she turns out to be the beneficiary of them. Okay, let's go on to the next segment. This will consist of 3 short clips, 2 from O'Reilly, 1 from George Bush. In the first clip, O'Reilly engages in a bit of self-incrimination. I'll explain that after you hear it.
As you know, in Vietnam, I thought we were on the side of right. I thought we were doing the right thing trying to give the South Vietnamese a chance at freedom.
So Bill thought, in Vietnam, we were on the side of right, and we were doing the right thing. My question is, why didn't you fight in the war, Bill? You graduated high school in 1967. That was when the war was really heating up. You could have enlisted and gone to fight in this war where we were doing the right thing. But you didn't enlist. Instead, you went to college, where you automatically got a student deferment from the draft. You graduated college in 1971. The war was still raging. Tens of thousands of American soldiers had died. You could have gone and fought and helped out this noble effort. But you didn't do that. You went to teach high school in Florida. I don't know how you got to Florida. You were born and raised in New York and went to college there. I'm not 100% sure of this, but I grew up in that era, and I seem to recall that there was such a thing as a deferment for teaching in certain schools. Could your choice of career at that point, teaching high school, have had anything to do with avoiding the draft again with a teaching deferment? Then after teaching for 2 years, Bill went to graduate school at Boston University. Again, I can't remember perfectly, but there was also a deferment for grad students. Could that have been the reason why Bill all of a sudden went to grad school? By whatever means, Bill somehow avoided being drafted or even enlisting and had nothing whatsoever to do with the fighting in the Vietnam War, even though it was something where we were on the side of right. We were doing the right thing, he said. Now, this brings to mind when O'Reilly was debating Michael Moore, and Michael Moore asked Bill, "Bill, would you sacrifice your child to secure Fallujah?" Bill got all uppity and just refused to answer that question. But what he did say was, "Well, I, Bill Riley, would sacrifice my life to secure Fallujah." Easy for you to say now that you're a 50-something-year-old guy. Your record during the Vietnam War, when you could have enlisted, when you could have allowed yourself to be drafted, when you could have gone to fight, your record during that period where you did everything you could, it seems, to avoid getting sent to Vietnam in combat, well, that doesn't lend too much credence to your claim that you would give your life to secure Fallujah. Bill is, as usual, full of crap. The second O'Reilly clip involves him telling a blatant lie.
Fine tonight, the mail was all over the place last night. Al Ritchie, a story in New York. Bill, when talking with Peter King, you said MSNBC and CNN lean left. You're right, but why don't you be honest and say Fox News leans right? Well, this is a more traditional network, that's for sure, Mr. Ritchie, but the conservative label is a matter of opinion. We have just as many liberal voices on this network as conservatives, sir.
I'll skip over his gibberish about how Fox is more traditional, but the conservative label is a matter of opinion, whatever that means. We'll just address his claim that we have just as many liberal voices as conservative. Well, let's see who hosts their own shows. You got Bill O'Reilly, you got Tony Snow, you got John Gibson, Neil Cavuto, John Kasich, and Brit Hume. Six rock-ribbed conservatives. You got Hannity and Combs, where you got one conservative and one supposed liberal. To me, that adds up to 7-1, conservative versus liberal. Not exactly what Bill said, right? There's not just as many liberal voices as conservative voices. I know some right-wingers are going to go, "Oh, well, what about Greta and Geraldo? They're liberal." Not anymore, if they ever were. I've listened to both of them quite often. I don't think either has uttered a progressive thought since they came to Fox. In the case of Greta, she's become essentially a neutral cipher. Greta gives fawning interviews to war criminal Henry Kissinger, hardly something a liberal would do. And in the case of Geraldo, wow, He's gone over to the neocon side with his gung-ho support of the Iraq War. And of course, he's also become an O'Reilly ass-kisser extraordinaire.
Security looks like it's pretty good right now.
You can do it, Bill. You could do it better than the governor. Forget about the governor. Bypass the governor. You do it. You're the man to do it.
And the situation is even far more unbalanced when you add in the guest lists of these programs. I know for certain on Hannity and Combs that conservative guests and commentators and experts and Fox News analysts, the conservatives far outnumber the liberal ones they have. O'Reilly's statement was a blatant lie because he had to have known it was false when he said it. As Al Franken memorably put it, O'Reilly definitely is a lying liar who tells lies. Okay, enough of O'Reilly. Now let's go on to the Bush clip. At this stage in Bush's career, I certainly wouldn't bother to play a run-of-the-mill clip of him fumfering and stammering and not being able to speak. What's significant about this clip is it was played on a Fox News broadcast exactly as you'll hear it. I didn't put any pauses in there. This is just the actual clip from a Fox News broadcast the other day.
As for the second vacancy on the court, President Bush talked today about filling that position.
I have interviewed people from in the past and thought about people from all walks of life, and I will put the person who can do the job. But I am mindful that diversity is one of the strengths of the country.
The next Supreme Court nominee would.
Fox could have very easily edited that to make Bush sound less incoherent, or they could have chosen not to play it at all. It's certainly not a critical clip to have played. There's at least one person, apparently, at Fox News who really wanted to sock at the Bush and make him look like an idiot. When you think about the right wing pounding on Bush, or at least certain parts of it, the right wing pounding on Bush because of the Harriet Myers nomination, and I pointed out in my blog the other day that Newsmax.com, the ultra-right website, chose to run the full Associated Press story about the phony staged teleconference Bush had with the troops into Crete, not only to run it, but to headline it, Bush's talk with troops in Iraq staged. Bush's talk with troops in Iraq staged. This is a far-right website talking about their beloved commander-in-chief. If Bush is losing Fox and lesser lights like Newsmax.com, if Bush is losing Fox, he's lost the whole ballgame. If he isn't going to have their 24/7 propaganda drumbeat in his favor, he's through. Let's now go on to the final segment. I want to talk a bit about the role of the United States in the world. When debating foreign policy with right-wingers, they always make three assumptions about the role of the United States in the world. Sometimes the assumptions are stated, sometimes they're implicit in their argument. These assumptions have become so widely accepted that they can fairly be called myths about the U.S. role in the world. Myths, assumptions, I'll use the two terms interchangeably. In order to successfully debate a right-winger, you have to be able to tease out these assumptions, whether they're explicit or implicit, whenever they occur, and counter them. If you can't counter these implicit or explicit assumptions, it will be hard to win the overall point with the right-winger. Before I get into what those three assumptions are, I want to briefly describe what the world situation is economically. I've spoken often how in the United States, 10% of the people have 43% of the income and 70% of the wealth, and how that doesn't leave enough for the rest of the people to survive. The situation is similar if you look at things on a global scale. About 15 to 20% of the people in the world own between 80 and 85% of the wealth. That leaves only a tiny sliver, 15 to 20% of the wealth, for 80 to 85% of the people to live on. It's not enough for them to survive. Now, in the United States, proportionate to our population, the economic pie is much larger than in the world. So in the United States, those at the bottom generally are not starving to death. We don't have thousands of people dying in the streets of hunger. No doubt there are people who die here from lack of health insurance because they delay getting medical care until it's too late. I think the figure there has been estimated at 18,000 people a year in the United States die because of lack of medical insurance. However, in the world, the pie is so much smaller, the economic pie, that those at the bottom literally do starve to death. That horrible maldistribution of wealth is one of the reasons that every day around the world, 30,000 children under the age of 5 die from preventable hunger and or preventable disease. That's 11 million children every year under the age of 5 dying needlessly around the world. That's what the world economic situation is. Now, Let's get into what the three right-wing myths are about the U.S. role in the world. First myth, we are a very generous nation in helping the world's poor. The fact is, as with so many things right-wingers say, the exact opposite. It's true that in absolute dollars we give the most. However, that's not a good enough measure. You have to determine what is the person's base of giving, how wealthy is the person, how big is our economy, in other words. If you calculate it on the basis of how large a country's economy is, the United States is just about dead last among all the developed Western nations in the amount of aid we give to the poor nations of the world. Now, if you tell that to a right-winger, they're likely to go,
"Oh, well, we're Americans and we don't depend on our government to give. We give through private charity, and if you add that in, we're way at the top."
No, that's not true. Even if you add in all our private charity giving, we're still just about at the bottom of the list of the developed nations. The second assumption, the second myth, is that the world economic system is essentially fair and that the United States is always working to make it fairer to the underdeveloped poor nations of the world. Again, wrong. The global economic system set up after World War II and continuing to the present day in the form of the IMF, the World Bank, etc., is designed for one thing, to extract wealth from the underdeveloped nations and send it to the developed nations. In other words, colonialism by another name. One of the worst ways it does that has been in the news a lot lately, the international debt situation of the poor nations. How did that work? Well, the IMF, the World Bank, they all made massive loans to these dictators that ran these third world countries. They knew that the dictators were not using the money to help the poor of the nations. The dictators were stealing the money or using it to develop their own military capabilities to keep their population under control. And then what happens when it comes time to repay the loan? The dictator doesn't take it out of his own pocket. No. What they do is, often under IMF orders, they drastically cut back whatever meager, inadequate public resources are presently devoted to health care, education, and otherwise helping the poor in those countries, who are the majority in each of those countries. And the poor have to pay the taxes that are going to repay the loan. The rich in those countries often don't pay any taxes. They just avoid it. They evade it. So our financial institutions in the West knowingly loan to dictators who steal the money, and then when the money has to be repaid, it comes out of the food, out of the medicine, out of the healthcare, out of the housing of the poor in those countries. I mean, let's face it, the major industrial Western powers in the world are essentially the same ones which ran the world during the period of 19th and 20th century colonialism. I think we can assume that there's been no major evolution in human ethics since then that would inhibit the economically powerful from exploiting the weak. And indeed, the income and wealth inequality between the Western powers and all these former colonies has been increasing since the end of the former colonial era. So, the world economic system is not fair, wasn't designed to be fair, and it's not going to be fair if it continues the way it is. The United States was instrumental in setting up this system, and we're the major player controlling it now. We don't want to change it to make it more fair. We're always the ones objecting to changes to make it more fair or dragging our heels in connection with measures like that. As I mentioned, international debt relief, terms of trade between nations, all those things. We don't want to make it more fair because we benefit from it too much the way it is now. You don't believe me? Well, let's go straight to the horse's mouth. George Kennan was one of the most influential and respected diplomatic and foreign policy figures in the 20th century. Listen to what he wrote in 1948 in a national security memo when he was the head of a State Department planning committee. Quote, "We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity without positive detriment to our national security. To do so, we will have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming, and our attention will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. We need not deceive ourselves that we can afford today the luxury of altruism and world benefaction. The day is not far off when we are going to have to deal in straight power concepts. End of quote. That's what George Kennan, prominent State Department planning official, wrote in a national security memorandum in 1948. Pretty much demolishes the myth that the world economic system is fair, or even if it's not fair, the United States wants to make it fair. Pretty much demolishes that, doesn't it? The third assumption, the third myth, is that the United States supports democracy throughout the world. Other than Japan and Germany after World War II, which were first world nations anyway, if you look at the history of the United States in the Third World, it's complete support of dictatorships. As it was supposedly said about the dictator Somoza in Nicaragua, he's an SOB, but he's our SOB. Well, as long as we had our SOB in power, we didn't care what those dictators did to the people of those countries. Not only do we support dictators, sometimes we overthrew democratically elected governments and install dictators. Where did we do that? Well, a partial list would include Iran, Guatemala, Chile, Indonesia, Zaire, formerly known as the Congo. We installed dictators in Nicaragua and the Philippines. We still support dictators in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the Stans nations near Afghanistan. In fact, you'd be really hard-pressed to, if you threw a dart at a map of the world, or even looked at it more methodically, to find any place in the Third World where we've really supported true democracy. Just look at the situation with Iraq. Everyone keeps saying, even a lot of liberal commentators, well, you know, our goal is to install democracy there, so it's really a good goal after all. BS! We're not trying to install democracy there. We're trying to install a puppet government that'll let us control the oil and maintain access to our military bases there. I mean, after all, what did we do in the 1950s in the country next door? They had a democratically elected government there in Iran, and we overthrew it and installed a brutal dictator called the Shah. So whenever a right-winger, either explicitly or implicitly, brings up one of these phony myths about the U.S. role in the world, that we're generous, that we work to make the world economic system fair, that we work to spread democracy, you have to stop them and counter that particular myth or myths that they've brought up. Once you do that, the rest of the argument against the right-winger will be much easier. Well, that'll about wrap it up for today. If you enjoyed what you heard, I have an entire website full of great material. It's www.therationalradical.com. Also, if you like what you heard, please tell your friends about it. And if they don't know about podcasting, turn them on to it. Let me also mention that my older podcasts are not, for the most part, dated. They're not linked to any story of the day. I try to make each podcast something that can stand on its own and be listened to months later. So feel free to check out some of my oldies but goodies. The three that I recommend are podcast number 2, about how right-wingers have the same psychological profile as serial killers. Number 7, about the need for a federal minimum wage that's set at a so-called living wage level. And number 9, which is the introduction to my whole analysis of how to effectively debate right-wing Christians. I love getting comments from listeners. You can send them to me at rational@adelphia.net. I've been getting a lot of listener mail. I wanted to read some of it this podcast, but it's already gone on too long, so I'll save them for next week. The song that I opened today's podcast with, and that I'll close with about 60 seconds of, is called Taking My Country Back by Honky Tonkers for Truth out of Nashville. Until next time, I'll sign off and say I love you all, including all you right-wing pieces of crap.
We had a bundle in the treasury drawer, more than there had ever been before. But every day we're drowning deeper in debt. Maybe 4 years should be all you get. Then you gave tax breaks to the millionaires, and you tried to make the working man pay. But you can't tax a man when his job's not there. Now look at where we are today. Hey, I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating me.